Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Monday, June 30th. We are almost to the halfway point of 2025. Can you believe it? This year is just going by so fast. And we are getting rapidly toward the end of the U.S. Supreme Court term. And so the Supreme Court last Friday ruled in favor of parents. This was a great decision, seeking to opt out their children of school lessons that include LGBTQ-themed material, citing religious freedom concerns. The 6-3 decision in the case of Mohammed v. Taylor allows parents in Montgomery County, Maryland, to excuse their elementary school children. I mean, think about how young these kids are. This is elementary school. This isn't even like college, and we don't think our, 18, 19-year-olds are old enough to confront some of these different worldview challenges. We're not even talking about high school. These are elementary school kids. I mean, kids as young as like 6 and 7. And this is from instruction involving certain books with LGBTQ themes. Some of these were actually read from the court, and some of these themes, and it was really disgusting material, frankly. And the court, thankfully, determined that the school board's refusal to allow opt-outs unconstitutionally burdens the parents' rights to direct their children's religious upbringing. And so the ruling emphasized the constitutional protections of parental rights and the ability of parents to guide their children's upbringing. And we know from the Bible that children are vested by the Lord to their parents for upbringing, not to the state. So this is a great decision. And for more on the cultural context of this, where we go from here, the biblical worldview, let's welcome in Gino Geraci, who is the former pastor of Calvary Chapel South Denver, where I used to attend when I was in Colorado. And he also hosts a radio show on Salem in Denver, and always love to have him. I still consider him one of my pastors. So good morning, Gino. And this is a great win for parents and I think for sanity.
Well, good morning, Jenna. And it is a great win. And as you can imagine, there is an ever-increasing commitment to chip away parental rights. And there seems to be a cultural commitment to make sure that a biblical view is challenged. And so, again, it really is. But my deep concern about this is that it doesn't go far enough. I'm actually even concerned that 3 of the justices thought it's a good idea that the educational system, when you talk about, again, the nexus between religion and parental rights, that they argued that there are chilling effects if we do not tell our children that homosexual behavior is normal. And even what's the word I'm looking for? I'm looking for it has to be mainstreamed. So that's
normative,
my big concern.
Maybe.
My big concern is that we don't have a parental rights amendment, and it just seems to me that it's going to be challenged over and over and over again. But to your point, we have to ask that great big question. Do we have the right to direct the education and the care of our children? And of course, the Bible says that it argues that it's the primary responsibility of the parents. And so here we have this great big idea, even among Christians, that we abdicate the role of of educating our children, to the government school system trying to fool ourselves into thinking that the government school system is going to faithfully represent decency. Forget biblical reality, even decency.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's such a great point. Gina Geraci, my special guest this morning, Salem radio host and also a former pastor of Calvary Chapel, South Denver, that the left isn't going to stop. I mean, this is a win for now, and we can be thankful for that. We can be thankful that the 6-3 majority is because of President Trump's first term. But when you look at the three justices that are actually saying from the highest court in the land that somehow parents don't have the right to opt out and that this should be normalized and that it's somehow bigoted or whatever their view is, to suggest that parents can't opt out their kids and this should be able to be taught from a state-funded institution, that's insanity. I mean, and that's something that absolutely flies in the face of not only religious freedom, but parental rights and everything that our country is about. And so what steps do we need to take now in our culture? Because this wouldn't even be a case at the Supreme Court if everybody in America recognized that homosexuality is a sin, that we don't want to normalize anything LGBTQ plus, any of that. I mean, it's the same thing that we advocate in the pro-life community, that even if abortions were legal, but they were unthinkable, and we had so many other alternatives that nobody chose that decision, then the law would not need to confine us to morality.
Right. And so I think that there's several things that we have to constantly do. And one of those things is realize the cultural pressure. In other words, modern society normalizes sending children to government schools, making it seem like that's the default or the only option. You grew up with parents who loved you, who understood the dangers of indoctrination.
Yeah, and it is really dangerous.
Education.
Go ahead. We lost you just for the last few seconds of that.
Oh, what I was basically saying is that a lot of parents feel unequipped or unable to provide the alternative or a biblical education because of work, finance, or lack of support. And some Christian parents may not fully realize the biblical mandate, the spiritual danger of secular indoctrination. I'm thinking of Hosea chapter 4, verse 6. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And then there's this trust in the system. Some parents trust the public schools are going to provide a neutral or even positive education. And remember, the courts have consistently said, hey, you know what? There seems to be a hostility towards people of faith. And you'll notice that in this ruling, Greek Orthodox, Christian, and Muslims all joined together to confront the educational system. How often in the world do you find Jews, Gentiles, Muslims, and Christians all agreeing together that what the secular society is doing is unconscionable?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of bizarre coalition that you find with, you know, the feminists and the Christians who are all saying this is not okay that men are in women's sports. I mean, this is how absurd this whole LGBTQ mafia is to reality, that even the people completely opposed to a Christian biblical worldview who still have some semblance of morality are recognizing right. The harm that comes to the culture in this. And I think you're right, Gino, that a lot of parents, even Christian parents, think the state will provide a neutral education, or they think that they're ill-equipped to train their children with things like, you know, math, reading, writing, spelling. But they fail to recognize the even bigger obligation than those very important subjects are discipleship and discernment in the home.
Right. And I think that once we understand about that mandate for parental instruction, you know, in Deuteronomy 6:6, it says, "And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise." The idea being, hey, guess what? Part of the reality in which we live in is we get up in the morning, we live throughout the day, we go to bed at night, understanding that there's a God in heaven who's revealed the truth. And Paul talks about this in Romans chapter 1, where he basically says when people suppress the truth, when they suppress the truth, they damage both the conscience and then they challenge creation. And so we live in a world, in a society that denies the created order and that calls you to abandon your own deeply held convictions in your conscience. And so, yeah, we know that this is a culture war. It is a true, genuine divide. And we have to continually ask and answer ourselves, you know, the question, what will I do to ensure that my children are safe? That's why I'm talking about. I think that the court is going to have to come to grips with the fact that I don't know how difficult it would be to have a parental rights amendment, but it just seems crazy to me. You're a constitutional attorney, and I remember asking so many of my attorney friends, how is it possible that the Bill of Rights, that they don't offer sufficient legal protections for families?
Yeah, it is such a good question. And I always go back to what Justice Scalia once remarked, that the Constitution, including the Bill of Rights, is a mere parchment guarantee. If we don't have a society that is committed to enforcing the values, I mean, it's the same thing as a promise from, spouse to one another, or, you know, from parents to children. If your word is your bond, but you have to have an enforceable mechanism. And really in society, that should function as the church. And so the question, I think, for you and other pastors, Gino, and for Christians who, you know, we shouldn't just be, if we're not engaged in, you know, full-time ministry, we shouldn't just be pew sitters and going to church. So when I say the church, I include all of us who are Christians. What role should we play to help support this understanding of parental discipleship and navigating these issues so that our culture will continue to protect parental rights, and we don't even have to have these types of controversies that, you know, 100 years ago wouldn't have come up to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, I think we need to come to grips, and we need to ask and answer the question, does the parent have the right to direct education, the right to choose an alternative to public education, private, religious, homeschool, the right to, you know, the court has upheld in this decision, if I understand it correctly, that Justice Amy Coney Barrett, I guess, wrote for the majority, that affirming that parents have the right to make reasonable choices within public schools. And remember, the dissent is saying, well, if we allow parents to make reasonable choices, it's going to throw the whole government education system into chaos. And I'm thinking, let's hope so. Let's hope so. Let's hope that there is an educational, a social, civilizational goal that we have, that we're going to have citizens, not subjects. We're going to have education to have citizens who can function properly in society, rather than indoctrinated individuals who have been disconnected from a biblical worldview. So I think that's part of it, where we go, hey, we have to come to grips and ask and answer the question, will I live out my deeply held belief that I am the person responsible for the care, the custody, and the education of my child or my grandchild?
Yeah, and what should the church be doing to protect the family, because, you know, when you're talking about the Bill of Rights and the protections from our Constitution, you know, another thought that struck me as we're talking here is that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights really protect individual rights and not necessarily and specifically textually the family as a unit, where obviously the family is an institution that God ordained and specifically described in Scripture, and that would be a reason for something like a parental rights amendment to specifically describe what a family is. And when we've been talking about, you know, things like President Trump's IVF executive order, for example, a few months ago, the concern that I had in that is that when he talks about family, it doesn't define it. And that allows the open door to all of this LGBTQ nonsense, which is really the left's view. They want to take and distort that definition of a family. And so when that isn't, that whole idea isn't explicitly protected in the Constitution in terms of the rights that are protected, but we do know, you know, that other case law and so forth has protected parental rights, what can we do as Christians to more explicitly define what a family is and ensure that, just like the definition of marriage is one man, one woman, we have to, as conservatives, properly define family as one mom, one dad, and children?
Yeah, I think, again, there's the compassion portion. I can remember long ago with Focus on the Family, and there were bumper stickers that said, "Focus on your own bleep family." In other words, we live in a broken world, a culturally broken world, where we understand that not every family is a mom and a dad and children. You know, you have an ideal situation, and in a sin-wracked world, we have single moms, we have single dads, we have step-parent situations, we have all kinds of different situations. But I think, to your point, we still have to hold out the ideal of God's created order. And the ideal of God's created order is, well, there is a created order. Men are not women. Women are not men. Marriage is an institution that's founded by God. It isn't a social, cultural, or civilizational construct. It's something deeply ingrained in what it means to be a human being. So, how, again, we have to go all the way back to that beginning from a government standpoint and ask and answer the question, will Christians be salt and light? Will we elect people who embrace these views? Remember, all the way back to the beginning, that a constitutional government purple, but mentality. Even as Christians, we've compromised. So I think that, again, we have to begin to live out our deeply held beliefs about the biblical revelation. And so, will it affect the culture? I hope so. I hope that there's going to be a growing group of people who find that that by denying the creation mandate, that it throws our culture into chaos, not order. And I'm not talking about some sort of rigid order. I'm talking about a compassionate order that understands that human flourishing is going to take place in a biblical construct, where we ask and we answer the question, is this good and decent and pure? In other words, we can't participate in suppressing the truth and unrighteousness, but rather in expressing the truth with biblical joy that God in Christ tells us something about reality, and that Jesus still provides the satisfying solution to the problem of sin in the great culture in which we live. And I think that's what's happening, I think, with this decision that you've been talking about. It's a parental pushback where they go, hey, we have to ask ourselves an honest question. Do we want government schools to be the source of understanding about what is real and what's not real? And parents are saying, you've gone too far. You are not only not neutral, you're hostile to a biblical view.
Yeah. Well, Gino Gerace, we have to take a break here, but you know, these are a lot of really important topics, and I think beyond just celebrating this decision, this is why I wanted to address the biblical worldview this morning, because we still have a lot of work to do as Christians in our culture, in recognizing the definitions that God himself ordained of marriage and family and parenthood, and ensuring that our culture comes back to a norm that is grounded in the biblical worldview, not just forced by a U.S. Supreme Court that then will continue to get appealed and appealed and appealed in other contexts or tried again. You know, this case is done, of course, in the Supreme Court, but that doesn't mean that the left won't continue to try to push their cultural Marxist agenda. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
The month of June has been hijacked by the anti-Christian culture to show their pride in something God calls an abomination. When you support AFR, you help us continue to stand for godly values and provide the resources for you to stay in the know about the enemy's tactics. To say thank you for your gift this month, we'll give you the booklet, Inside the LGBTQ Push of the 1990s, to help strengthen your convictions. Just go to afr.net/offers. afr.net/offers.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court also issued a really great opinion in the birthright citizenship case also last Friday. And CNN's headline was Supreme Court limits ability of judges to stop Trump. It kind of sounds like they're complaining about that, as if like that's what the founders meant in Article 3, that, you know, we're giving the one Supreme Court power just to in the future stop Trump. That's like their entire existence. That kind of made me laugh. But what will the Supreme Court's ruling mean for birthright citizenship? And Ketanji Brown Jackson, her dissent was just utterly ridiculous in this case. So for more on this, let's go to Bill Jacobson, who is the founder of Legal Insurrection. And Bill, you know, this was a great opinion. And yet, you know, the media is framing this as if this should just be about Donald Trump.
That's right. I mean, this really has to do with enforcing the constitutional structure. The Constitution created the Supreme Court and then left the jurisdiction and creation of any lower courts to the Congress. And the Congress created rules for the lower federal courts. And the Supreme Court just ruled that the lower federal courts, meaning the district courts and the courts of appeal, exceeded the authority Congress had given them. So this is not about Donald Trump. It's about preventing what Justice Barrett referred to as the imperial judiciary, that the federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction. They can only rule upon and exercise the authority given to them, and they've exceeded it. So it's not about Donald Trump. It's about preventing the perversion of our constitutional system by justices like Ketanji Brown Jackson, who think federal judges can do whatever they want and have unlimited power. And that's just not the case.
Yeah. And this was a great just smackdown, I think, by Amy Coney Barrett to Ketanji Brown Jackson. She said, in part, "We will not dwell on Justice Jackson's argument, which is at odds with more than two centuries worth of precedent, not to mention the Constitution itself. We observe only this: Justice Jackson decries an imperial executive while embracing an imperial judiciary." And Bill, you just mentioned that line, the imperial judiciary, and that's exactly what the left wants. And they've wanted that for a long time. And this is why they were so upset that the balance of the court has shifted conservative, because for a long time we've seen them use the U.S. Supreme Court as an imperial role, that basically, you know, nine unelected, just appointed justices then make all of these policy decisions that the Constitution does actually textually vest in Congress or with the executive branch. And so this was a great line. And I think that even more than just the outcome of the specific facts in this case overarchingly, that shows a very different view of the Constitution, a correct view, than what the left has been suggesting for the last, you know, 60 plus years.
Right. The left's method of operation is when you can't win an election, you get the Supreme Court or the lower federal courts to rule in your favor. And that's what we're seeing now. Donald Trump won both the popular and the electoral college vote. Republicans control both houses of Congress, although not by much in the House. And Democrats look to federal district court judges to try to stymie that. And that's what happened. I mean, this was a very pre-planned lawfare project. Even the New York Times reported in late November of 2024 that Democrat groups were organizing to do exactly what they're doing now, that they had mustered over 800 attorneys and over 40 groups who would sue the Trump administration over everything to try to undo the results of the election. And the result of the election were the policies advocated by Donald Trump. And unfortunately, they have found some federal judges, not all of them. Some of them have been very cautious and very proper, but they found enough of them to try to disrupt the Trump 2.0 administration. And the reason that, you know, the ruling from the Supreme Court is so important is that these universal injunctions, which have not been completely eliminated, just scaled back, we're not out of the woods yet, but these random universal injunctions have been used to essentially negate the impact of the election. And so I think it's an important ruling, and as the court pointed out, federal district court judges have to stay in their lane. And it's a pretty wide lane. They get to do a lot of stuff, but they don't get to impose their viewpoints on the rest of the nation.
Yeah, which is excellent, as you mentioned, in practice, because a federal judge that has been selected by plaintiffs seeking simply to thwart the policy execution over the next, you know, 4 years of Trump. And of course, the left will continue to do that with any Republican or non-leftist president. That has now been severely limited. But what does that actually look like in practice in terms of where the court left open, you know, a little bit of room for injunctions, but overall have really move to curtail lower court orders that hamper the enforcement of a policy agenda from the executive?
Yeah, well, there's enough of a loophole that if they want to, the plaintiffs and the federal district court judges can drive a truck through it. And there's two loopholes that I see. The first one is very obvious, and the court discussed it, and it was discussed at oral argument on this in this case, is class actions. So that there is a procedure in federal court where you can have class-wide, meaning essentially national impact. Everybody in a certain class of persons would be covered by the case, even if they are not individually parties in the case. And so I think what we're going to see is a lot of this being reframed as class action relief rather than individual relief on a nationwide basis. And that's already started. The group CASA, I think their name is, has already refiled their complaint or filed an amended complaint trying to cast this case as a class action. But there are class action rules, and there are certain things that need to be followed, and it will slow things down a little bit. So that's loophole number one, is a lot of these nationwide injunctions are going to recast as class actions. Loophole, you know, number two is the court said that you can't have these universal injunctions except if it's necessary for complete relief. And I think the birthright citizenship case maybe is a case where they might be able to argue that. And there is a logic to having a single uniform birthright citizenship rule in the country. And so I could see that that might survive. So those are the two loopholes, class actions and framing the universal injunctions as necessary to achieve complete relief. But that said, at least there has been an admonition from the Supreme Court, and it's much more likely in light of that, that either district court judges would be more hesitant to do something or that appeals court judges would be more likely to issue a stay of those actions.
And I think that's really good strategy to understand, you know, okay, where will then the left. I mean, they're not just going to give up and go home. You know, again, like we were talking about in the first segment with parental rights and, you know, the LGBTQ stuff. It's not like here with the opposition of Trump's policies, they're just going to say, well, OK, we tried and the Supreme Court said this, so we might as well pack up and go home and not try to thwart his policies. They'll try to figure out a different way and a different line of attack. And so hopefully the Trump administration is prepared for this and they'll kind of see some of this coming and be able to respond effectively in line with not just the opinion itself, but the obvious spirit of this decision, which is that we don't have an imperial judiciary. And I hope that that line continues to come up again and again and again to consistently smack down the left, including Ketanji Brown Jackson. But it should trouble us, I think, a little bit. Bill Jacobson, my special guest this morning, from founder of Legal Insurrection, that we have justices who are actually arguing for that in writing from the bench. I mean, that's didn't she go to law school? I mean, didn't she read the U.S. Constitution? This is absurd.
Yes, and the majority decision, the 6-3 decision, was very frankly derogatory towards her, and deservedly so. They essentially accused her of being completely ignorant of our constitutional structure, and I think you read part of that. And that's astounding because 6 justices signed on to that. You could have had, if the justices say in the majority, well, we don't really want to attack her personally. We don't want to, you know, denigrate her intelligence, which is essentially what it does. You know, if you want to say that, put it in a concurring decision, but don't put it in the majority. But they didn't say that. They all signed on to it. They signed on to a statement which didn't use the word ignorant, but called her ignorant of our constitutional history and structure, and somebody who is contrary to that tradition. And that's pretty astounding that 6 people, including the Chief Justice, signed on to that.
Well, let's also move topics here before I run out of time with you, because I also wanted to get your commentary, Bill Jacobson, on this report that the Trump Justice Department, of course, headed by Attorney General Pam Bondi, has fired 3 additional. These aren't the first firings of January 6th prosecutors. And the firings come months after President Donald Trump pardoned more than 1,500 people connected to January 6th. This comes from USA Today. And so, you know, this is, of course, going to be a headline, but, you know, is this overall a good thing in your view to fire prosecutors? Because I can see kind of 2 sides of this. One is that there was obvious lawfare that was involved on, you know, tons of levels here. But then there are also some career prosecutors that were there, you know, beyond the Biden administration. This was, you're assigned a case. I mean, I've been a prosecutor in the past. I didn't get to pick and choose what cases I was assigned from my chief. And so is this a matter of politics more than it is fairness, or what's your view on this?
Well, I don't know the reasons they stated for removing those 3. I think what I've seen reported is simply that 3 prosecutors who were on the January 6th prosecution team have been terminated or removed. But we don't know why. I mean, there have been a lot of cutbacks in the federal government. But presuming that it was because of their role, if that's the presumption, then, you know, I think if you're a career federal prosecutor and you've done nothing wrong, you've handled the cases assigned to you and you did the best job you could, I don't think we should be firing people for that. If there is some information that these 3 particular prosecutors were overzealous or breached some protocol or breached some, you know, ethics rule, then I think it's perfectly appropriate. I think we'd need to know more about why these 3 people were removed, because I don't think as a career prosecutor you should be removed just because you got put on a case which ends up being, you know, for half the country, politically unpopular.
Yeah, and I think that that's a reasoned view of this, which is why, frankly, it concerns me that there are conclusions being jumped to on both sides, frankly, that, you know, the left is suggesting that this is only political, and then the right is saying, you know, good, get rid of them. You know, largely, obviously, there are some rational voices like yours and hopefully mine. But I think that that's the correct view because, you know, there's going to be in any national attention prosecution, and this is well beyond January 6th. I mean, there were so many prosecutions that that the public, the court of public opinion, has very strong views on, and often two opposing sides of strong views. And if it were the practice that then, you know, whatever side the ultimately the elected district attorney, U.S. attorney, or, you know, the appointed AG comes in, and whatever side they're on, then if it's opposing to the side that was on the prosecutor, then you just get rid of them, then those positions would necessarily be more political than, frankly, they should be. So I agree with you that we need more information, but I think the overarching point for our listening audience is that we shouldn't just applaud this. We shouldn't also just say, well, this went too far, before knowing more. And the rule hopefully should be that these offices are not used for political lawfare, which obviously they have been in the past. And how do we stop that? How could Congress stop that more? How could a state stop that more, of these types of prosecutions being political?
Well, it's tough because prosecutors have a lot of discretion, but it, you know, the fish rots from the head. And there was a political decision at the highest level of the Biden administration to pursue these, not just against individuals, but to make it an attack on the entire Trump movement and the entire Republican Party. And therefore, you have very innovative claims that never get prosecuted, like parading in the Capitol. I mean, who in the past has gotten, prosecuted for parading in the Capitol, for expanded notions of being in a restricted area? Who could have known that you were in a restricted area? And so that really was the problem, is that this was used as a political cudgel. They didn't just say, okay, let's review the video, and people who committed violence will be prosecuted like anybody else who commits violence on a Capitol policeman. That's not what we said. It was bring down the entire Trump movement, bring down the Republican Party, and that's what they set out to do. So this was, you know, the fish rotted from the head. This was not a normal criminal prosecution. This was a politically motivated criminal prosecution that went very far and wide.
Well said. Well, we have to take a break here, but Bill Jacobson, a founder of Legal Insurrection, always appreciate your comments. And of course, you can follow Legal Insurrection on X, and you can follow them at LEG or Ledge Insurrection. And you can also find them at legalinsurrection.com. And, you know, all of these things, we always have to go back again to the principle, to the rule, and to ensure that some of these offices are not used for partisan political purposes, including the U.S. Supreme Court, right? Because they should not be policy driven, especially that office, and including prosecutors' offices. And this is why the Bill of Rights has more protections for the individual against the power of the state than anything else, because our founders understood just how bad lawfare can be. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. This June 24th marks 3 years since Roe v. Wade was overturned. But here's what you may not know. Abortion numbers have surged to a 10-year high. The battleground has shifted from the courtroom to our homes. Today, over 60% of abortions happen through the abortion pill, taken in silence and often alone. Preborn Network clinics are standing in the gap, meeting women in their most desperate hour. And here's what they're seeing. Young mothers, terrified and misled, are delivering their babies, tiny, perfectly formed, onto bathroom floors. These precious babies, once called just tissue, now are lifeless. 11% of these women who take the abortion pill will suffer serious health complications. Countless others carry emotional scars for a lifetime. When you give to Preborn, you're not just saving a baby, you're saving a mother as well. You're giving her hope, financial support, and the truth. Preborn has already rescued over 350,000 babies, but there are so many more who need our help. Your tax-deductible gift makes this mission possible. To donate now, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And a very interesting headline from late yesterday. GOP Senator Tom Tillis won't seek re-election, he announced in North Carolina after drawing Trump's ire. That's a headline from NBC this morning. Tillis made the surprise announcement one day after he opposed a massive bill for Trump's agenda in the Senate. So he announced Sunday he won't run for re-election, and this surprise decision opens up a seat in the battleground North Carolina that was already set to be one of the most hotly contested races of the 2026 midterms between the primary for Tillis and then a few others that are running. And of course, the speculation is whether or not Laura Trump will now get into that race. So you'll recall, though, and for those of you that follow me on X and social media and otherwise, you'll recall that Tom Tillis is the one that was pushing an amendment as well to the One Big Beautiful Bill that would strip Americans of the ability to bring justice against mega corporations, insulating big tech and big pharma and other woke institutions from legal accountability. So he was deceptively marketing this as taxing quote-unquote foreign litigation funding, when in reality it would subject all litigation funders to a 41% levy. And this would have an effect that Americans fighting against woke corporations, like I'm thinking of my friend Robbie Starbuck or even AFA Action, and some of those would lose one of the few tools needed to fight back. And so, you know, there was a lot of just concern over Tom Tillis and where he actually stood within the Republican Party and within the broader conservative values. For me, it doesn't really matter if there's an R or D. It matters what your vote is. It matters, are you conservative? Are you do you have fidelity to the principles of the Constitution, and are you going to execute upon them? So I feel no love lost that Senator Tillis is not running for re-election. I think this will be a very interesting primary to watch. But let's welcome in Chris Ekstrom, who is on the U.S. Term Limits Board of Directors and has become one of our favorite commentators here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. So, Chris, we love having you and your thoughts overall on Tillis.
Good morning, Jenna. Well, you know, my first thought when I heard it was good riddance. That's one that we don't have to spend a lot of money to get rid of, because the truth about Tom Tillis is he was the perfect swamp operator. He didn't really get himself to the high level of profile of a John Cornyn or a Lindsey Graham, where most people who follow politics nationally on our side, they know that those are two guys that, you know, are pretty much rhino poster boys or worse. And Tillis flew under the radar. And I think what you mentioned, Jenna, about him was really his most sinister, and it really was sinister, aspect. He was an apologist for the big corporations who absolutely wanted to stop grassroots people from challenging them. And, you know, he was happy to go along with whatever woke insanity that just was du jour. You know, he would be there for them. And so for him to step aside, that just saves us some money and allows us to point our guns in some other directions.
Yeah, and that's a great point that the Republicans can now focus on a kind of an open seat with a primary candidate and not kind of have this this battle in the primary, and then can maybe focus on the general. But, you know, even according to Politico yesterday, their headline is that Democrats just scored a massive new pickup opportunity in North Carolina, but Republicans are determined not to let them have it. So is there a possibility, because you don't have an incumbent that is as strong for re-election as Tillis may have been, that this is an opportunity for a Democrat pickup?
Well, because I'm, courageous conservatives pack is something that I've founded and have been fighting against rhinos and phony two faces like Tom Tillis. I'm always thrilled and willing to take the so-called risk that we could lose a seat under those circumstances. So that's my particular bent, and I just want to make that clear. But look, I was one of the people who helped keep Tillis around when he was running against a really, really terrible Democrat last time. And a guy, this was a Democrat who had actually disgraced himself in the military by his conduct. And we made the hard decision to try to help Tom Tillis, who we knew was terrible, but we thought it was important. At this stage in the game, and from where we're headed, I hope, with MAGA and with, you know, movement conservatism and people on the right in general, I think, Jenna, it's time to get some, make sure that we have real people that we support all the time that are going to do what they say they're going to do. So, for example, who I would love to see get into this race is Dan Bishop. You may recall him. He ran for attorney general. He was a congressman. He's currently in the Trump administration. And frankly, I had thought about starting a movement to draft Dan Bishop. I'm told by people who are close to him, and he's not a personal friend of mine, but I have known him, that he's pretty happy in his job up there. But Dan Bishop is the kind of guy who, in my estimation, would use the Senate power to stop some of the really horrible things. And Tommy Tuberville did it with this abortion traveling for the military, and he did his best to prevent that by preventing the promotions from going up. I see a guy like Dan Bishop as somebody who could use that power.
And so you're speaking of the Deputy Director of the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, for those who aren't familiar with Dan Bishop. And so this raises the question, because I think, you know, that's a great choice of a candidate. You know, we've already seen a few others that are being circulated, like I mentioned, Laura Trump off the top. So do you think then, Chris Ekstrom, that GOP unity will hold and center around one primary candidate? Or now that Tillis is out of the way, we'll just end up spending a lot of money on a primary because there isn't an incumbent to fight against or one particular primary candidate to back?
Well, look, I'm inclined to go with President Trump about 90% of the time. But Lara Trump seems to be a somewhat reluctant candidate to me in the past. And, you know, she's well-spoken. There's certainly aspects. I've met her and like her. She knows politics. But, you know, I think all candidates are better with competition, because I want to push them all to the right, Jenna, and have that opportunity and make sure, you know, I don't want to end up with Libby Dole there. And so I think even if we have to spend a few bucks in the primary to pick the best Republican, that's good for everybody. And sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's a great point about pushing candidates further to the right to conservative values. I mean, this is why the primary in 2024, even though, you know, people were screaming about that with Trump, I think it ultimately actually helped him and made him a better candidate eventually and now president. And so does Tillis's exit to you exemplify kind of a broader shrinking of moderate voices in the GOP that we are kind of seeing an effect of this overall MAGA movement?
I hope so. And I don't even like to give them the benefit of the word moderate, because I don't think most of what they do is based on any sort of sense that they want to be moderate or work across the aisle or any of that nonsense that they say. I think what it's all about is they just don't support what we support. And then they go in and lie to us and mouth support for us. And when the things push comes to shove, we don't see them. They're missing in action. I mean, look, we got a lot of underperforming politicians, and very few that I, in my opinion, could tell you that I admire. You know, we have this audience. I'll bet there's a lot of people in Louisiana, and they've got one down there, Senator Bill Cassidy. I mean, he's just terrible. And he clearly just dislikes the president personally, I think. And his politics are often driven by concerns that have nothing to do with the typical voter that supported him. Now, that's just something we don't have to tolerate. And so I guess what I'm saying here with these guys who have hung on and hung on and hung on, they need to go. I mean, I'm a U.S. term limit guy, obviously, too. So seeing a fifth term for John Cornyn or Lindsey Graham, you know, frankly, makes me sick.
Yeah, well, you and me and DeSantis and other stalwart conservatives, Chris Ekstrom, really appreciate it. And again, he's on the board of directors for U.S. Term Limits, so, you know, that should signal his position on the issue. But as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. And this is going to be a great week heading into a celebration of July 4th, our country's founding. You're not going to want to miss our special programming coming up on Friday. But have a great Monday, and I will talk to you tomorrow. And again, always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.